This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome back to Elgium Talks, the podcast from Legal & General Investment Management. Investors have often worried about China, from a slowdown in growth to a hard landing, but this often minimises the massive trends taking place. These offer a number of data points for long-term optimism, as well as selective investment opportunities. Here today to talk to us about how Legal & General Investment Management are looking at China are global economist James Carrick and fund manager Viral Gandhi. Thanks for joining us, guys. Can we start us off, James? Can we really pin down some of these massive trends that are happening in China at an economic level?
Yeah. China historically has grown at a double-digit rate. It's now growing around 6%. That's the government's new target. People are worried that this is a significant slowdown in growth. I think the big picture people have missed is that China has tripled in size since about 2005. And so if it grows at a 5 to 6% pace, it will be contributing more to world economic growth than it did when it was growing at a double-digit pace in 2007 at the peak of the last boom.
So by that we mean of all the growth of the world, the GDP global growth, China makes up a larger portion of that. What kind of portion are we talking about here?
It's accounting for about a third of world growth, just under 1% contribution to world growth, and the world economy is growing at just under 3%.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense that it's come a long way, but it's still slowed down slightly. Viral, can you tell us a little bit more from perhaps more granular level? What's going on in China?
So there's clearly a very big shift to consumption. So I think an important fact to be clear on is that China is already a consumption powerhouse. So one third of cars sold in the world are to Chinese consumers. That's up from about 5% in 2000. I certainly, you know, back then, no one was expecting the explosion that we've had in the Chinese car market. We've spoken to a few German premium automakers who tell us that as a proportion of their profits, if you include what's made in China and luxury vehicles exported to China, Chinese consumers account for more than half of their profits. And within luxury consumption, a recent McKinsey report found that about a third of the global luxury market is attributed to Chinese consumers. One other area is in travel. So Chinese tourists are one fifth of international tourism expenditure. And that's in a context when less than 10% of Chinese people have passports. So it's already a very large consumption market. And over time, it will clearly become larger. So nominal GDP is only $9,000 per year.
Yes, so I wanted to draw out that distinction because the way you've presented it there, of course, these are some incredible numbers of like a wealthy, developing country of that's contributing so much to global growth, as James pointed out. And yet the GDP per capita is only 9,000. Well, where's the dichotomy here?
So clearly the point to make is it's a very large population. So even with only about a third of the population earning more than $10,000 a year, it is still a hugely globally significant market. You know, you can, even with one third of Chinese consumers starting to travel, you can become one third of the global luxury market, one fifth of the international tourism market. So it's just, we've seen this kind of growth in other countries, in Korea, Taiwan, Japan, but the size of population for these countries is smaller than China. China, as China gets richer, the sheer quantum is very large.
Yes, that plays into a lot of the narratives that we hear about China of being talked in such massive terms of being the most populous country, one of the largest countries in the world. How can trends in that be managed? Is it so granular of small regions, small cities, small markets, or can we really think of this as a huge economic block?
So it's a very interesting point. China, it hugely varies between provinces. So the growth to date has very much been concentrated in the coastal regions, in the big cities like Shanghai, Beijing. I do think over time you will see provinces outside of the coastal areas becoming richer. That's certainly coming from government. I think they want to see more of an even economic distribution. They are trying to increase incomes for poorer consumers within China. And also, part of it is just driven by labor costs. So in the past, when China was just opening up to the world, the coastal regions had very low wages and you had industrialization, wages have elevated very significantly in these regions. And so you start to see manufacturing move away from those regions, and then that increases incomes across the whole of China.
Can we understand that in GDP per worker, have incomes increased?
Yeah, I mean, as Vil said, China's close to double digit, thousands of dollars per head, and it's practically tripled. So it was probably about 3,000 or something in the mid-2000s.
Wow, so it's really kind of catapulted and looks set to grow further. Is that what we're saying? Despite the level of growth having slowed slightly, there's still this high growth.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. How much scope has China to catch up further? So you can look at GDP per person or GDP per worker, because we know that the Chinese labour force is ageing and they have a low birth rate. So I think we probably need to look at GDP per worker than per person. And GDP per worker, what's fascinating is that China today is about the same as Japan in 1970, Taiwan in 1986, and Korea in 1990.
So there's a real regional blueprint that it almost is following here.
Yeah, so just think how poor Japan was in 1970. That's like 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's tremendous scope to catch up, because even compared to, say, Korea in 1990, the internet wasn't invented then. So if you're trying to catch up with the United States, Japan was much closer to the United States in 1970 than China is today, because you just needed a few steel factories and automobile factories and you've caught up with the United States. But the US is much richer because of technology and software. So there's a much bigger gap that China still has to be able to catch up to.
Cyril, do you want to add anything to that?
As a fund manager who's focused on Asia, I found James's chart hugely optimistic and reassuring about my career choice, because it clearly shows that China is following the trajectory that you have seen in other countries like Taiwan and South Korea. It's at very, very early stages. And then if you look at previous financial crises, so if you look at the great financial crisis on this chart, it's barely a blip in terms of productivity per worker. This is a very long-term trend. So over the next 20 to 30 years, I mean, you will clearly see China's productivity per worker rising and getting closer to where countries like South Korea are now. And optimistically, it's not like the US has stagnated. You can see the US GDP per person employed is continuing to rise. So even beyond that initial phase of catch-up, there's still plenty of room for China to grow beyond that.
So if I'm understanding that right, it's not that China is catching up to the US because the US has stalled. It's still that China has a faster rate of growth in productivity. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
But and yet when we think about this of being 9,000 GDP per capita, this is still, we talk about the burgeoning Chinese middle class here. And while you have this sector of very wealthy contributing such to cars, autos, luxury, the middle income trap is a phrase that's often used in relation to China and other developing countries. Can you tell us a little bit more about the general development of the country relative to everyone else? And can it escape this so-called trap?
Yeah, so the fear of the middle income trap, for example, was espoused recently by the World Bank looking at the future of China. They noted that there was about 100 middle income countries in 1960. Only 13 of those have successively become high income.
Okay.
Most of them just became relatively middle income, particularly those in the Middle East, like Egypt, and in Latin America, like Brazil. Brazil didn't do anything in the 1980s and 1990s and a lot of the 2000s in terms of its overall GDP per capita. But some countries did very well. And I think we can split them into two broad groups. We have the PIGS, Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain.
Yep.
They joined the European Union. They benefit from free trade. They benefit from stable legal institutions, and they caught up as factories, you know, across Europe traded and diverged. We also had a number of winners in Asia. We had Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, Singapore and Taiwan.
These major financial and technological powerhouses, really, now.
Yeah. Some of them are city-states, so we discussed the regional issues. And you could, to the downside, say, well, it's easy for Shanghai to be a successful city because it's
Cause
like
it's
Singapore.
So small. Yeah,
but can that be for the whole country? But I think the fortunes of Japan and Korea give you some optimism there. But some of these countries are US military allies. And I think one possible downside risk is that when you have a trade conflict between these Asian countries catching up and the United States, the US might have been encouraged to turn a blind eye. That's the focus of a book I read, which said that because Japan and Korea and Taiwan are US military allies, they turn a blind eye to big trade deficits.
Yeah.
China is not part of that US military alliance, and therefore you're now seeing tensions with the United States as it gets bigger and bigger, and those trade imbalances become more prominent.
The idea that I'm selling more to you than you are to me is okay when we're both on the same side, politically speaking, as it were, but actually when we're not, there is that tension, and that's we're bringing geopolitics into the world of economics here, is that right?
I think that's a double-edged sword. So on one scenario is that the hawks in the US administration see China as a threat, like they did the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. They don't like its politics, expansionism, and they want to curtail it and cut off trade and technology links.
A policy of containment, almost.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the other is that actually Trump says, look, you're no longer a poor country like you were when you joined the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. As we said, it's more than tripled in the last 15 years. You are a big country. You've now got to play by the rules. You've got to open up your economy to competition. Mm-hmm. You can't keep subsidizing state-owned enterprises. And so if it's a bit like for like Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain joining the European Union, just at a lesser extent. If Trump can drag China in to the global competitive framework, that would actually be very positive for long-run productivity. Of course, Trump could push China out of the global system. So it goes two ways.
Yeah. I mean, on the positive side, Trump could force them to move up the value chain. Move away from low-cost, low-end manufacturing to higher-end, IP-protected products and services.
So I was going to say, that's a very interesting point. Something I hadn't considered, but it's just come to me. Intellectual property reform, there's a lot of analysis that shows as a country develops, you know, initially it doesn't care for intellectual property. It's easy to buy pirated copies of Hollywood movies. But eventually their own domestic universities and companies produce innovative products. Mm. And then the rules change. Those companies lobby the government for property rights, which then benefits everybody else who was previously saying it's not fair that you're copying and cheating.
It's like a sudden seesaw going from, well, we should be able to freedom of the commons to suddenly, well, you know, we're producing very nice things, very nice intellectual property. Maybe we should have some of these protections. And it suddenly swings from one pendulum swings from one to the other very quickly indeed.
Yes. So in a sense, you can have a self-reinforcing process of catch-up once you get to that stage of respecting property rights.
Because you have a domestic lobby that actually cares about property rights because they've created some innovation they want to protect. Yeah.
So this comes back to China entering to the wider world system of international laws, norms, precedents. Mm-hmm. Was that not what their entry into the WTO was meant to achieve? I mean, everyone talks about that as a major turning point for China's development, where it really became this positive investment story. And I think anyone who invested in China in 2001 would have been very happy with their returns over the last 17 years. Why is this next move different from that?
There's a very interesting documentary and a book by Peter Navarro, one of the hawks in the US administration. Mm. He's very critical because he has video clips of Bill Clinton saying China's coming into the WTO and Clinton's a Democrat. US workers' representatives didn't like that, saw it as a threat. But Clinton promised, no, we're going to get China into the world. They're going to play by the rules. That's going to be a huge opportunity. And it's going to cause political reform within China. And so the hawks in the US administration, like Peter Navarro, are saying, well, China's kind of cheated. They've got in on the economic trade, but they haven't delivered the political freedom and reform that we were promised by Bill Clinton.
That's a very extreme hawkish view. What's perhaps a more slightly softer, more positive view, Vera?
So I think in terms of what's different now, China, when it joined the WTO, it was essentially exporting manufactured goods. And what it's attempted to do now is try to produce things that produce genuine innovation. Mm. So, you know, it's moving from simply being an outsourced manufacturer of Nike shoes to producing mobile phones like Huawei that are an attempt to be a similar quality to Apple.
Would be a reductionist to say moving from made in China to developed in China.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it, yeah. So in that context, you can understand why in the past they would care very little about IP. You know, in fact, the opportunity was for them to, when they start or being part of the outsourced chain, learning techniques, learning how to build these products. So they would be they would not respect the property rights in that context. But now, if they want to produce things that are genuinely innovative and market them to consumers all around the world, they have to adhere to global standards on IP. You simply cannot sell a Huawei phone in the US unless you adhere to those standards. Mm. And these markets, the US, Europe, are key consumer markets. So I think that's what makes the situation different now from when China joined the WTO.
But because there's such a development in this huge population, could China just rely on domestic growth? I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. To sell a Huawei phone in the UK, in the US, you have to abide by those rules. But is China a special case in that it's 1.9 billion people that you can just talk, that you could just sell to Chinese people and still be a global top 10 tier company?
So I think I would absolutely agree that you can be a very large player simply selling to Chinese consumers. So to date, Alibaba, Tencent, they mostly sell to Chinese consumers, and these companies are over $500 billion market cap businesses. I think the reason why export markets are important for Chinese companies is that the point we made earlier, Chinese GDP per capita still at the moment is $9,000 per person. It's not, it has positive prospects in my view for the future, but as of now, as a consumption market, it isn't as large as other markets in the world. You know, I think that companies like Huawei, if they were just competing in China, they would have to sell at a much lower average selling price than they would when they're selling to the US consumer and they're competing with a $1,000 plus iPhone. The Chinese smartphone market with players like Oppo, Vivo, they operate on razor thin margins and on much lower average selling prices. So that's why I think for certain companies, it is important to access the global market.
Has this played a part, this idea of a lower income cohort, that's what's really driven this demand for innovation in these sort of spaces, in that you don't, like the US, Canada, as I think in one of your examples of your blog, Viral, the cost of a mobile phone, the overall package of phone plus data is so much higher in these countries because average incomes just are higher. Mm-hmm. Has the fact that these large companies are trying to sell to a lower income in China driven the demand for like better innovation, or can it all be reduced to IP theft?
So I definitely think that a large section of the population that are on lower incomes creates innovation to market to that particular group. So there are examples like, so there's a very large migrant worker population in China. More than 200 million people in China are migrant workers on fairly low incomes. And they need to, holiday, Golden Week holiday, many of them go back to their home villages to see their family. Mm-hmm. This is a massive migration. And there's a tech company that recently launched a product that allowed them to buy their railway tickets online in a much more smooth process that meant they didn't need to queue up at windows or be exploited by ticket touts. That's a particularly Chinese problem, and it resulted in innovation. And I think there are many examples of this where that section or having a lower income consumer that does need to stretch their income does create innovation. Mm-hmm. One more point around Chinese innovation is that certain parts of Chinese innovation have moved a lot faster than technology in Western countries, partly because of the fact that privacy issues are less considered in China. So And also that you do have these very large, dominant tech companies that have been granted, I wouldn't say a monopoly status, but certainly a elevated status in the Chinese economy. So cash has, digital payments have moved much more quickly in China. People do use apps like WeChat to transfer money much more freely, pay for things in restaurants much more freely. So in some parts of technology, China actually has moved ahead of the West.
And I was going to mention, you're seeing that in AI and facial recognition. It's shown that if you jaywalk in China, they'll take a photo of your face, they'll identify you, and they'll send you a fine on your phone or put your name and face on a wall of shame. Maybe because of a lack of privacy issues, but they have, and you see this in academic papers and who companies like NVIDIA are working with, which universities, China is leading and competing with the United States and Europe on artificial intelligence.
I think that seems to be the real battleground that the US-China technological arms race, if to put it in militaristic terms. What can we understand from an investment management perspective of this?
Certainly, there is a lot of investment on all sides in AI. In terms of which countries will have the lead in this, I think it's too early to tell at this point. A lot of AI at the moment is applying essentially inferences to large data sets, there's the hope that we will get to a more advanced form of AI in the future that does not require simply applying regression to huge data sets. But who's going to win in that race? I really think it's too early to tell.
Too early.
But certainly in terms of ambition, Chinese companies like Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent are throwing a lot of money at the problem. They're hiring top talent to address it. And it is one of the areas that the Chinese government have prioritized as an area for development.
And I was going to add, this takes us back to that middle income trap question. You know, our central assumption in our analysis, that China continues to make a big contribution to the world, is it is going to follow the path of Korea and Japan and Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And central to that is developing technologies and being innovative, as we've seen with a lot of products from those countries. And so the work that they've done on quantum computing or, you know, putting explorers on the far side of the moon does show technological innovation and leadership, which is not the same that you would associate with a country like Egypt or Brazil, where you've had corrupt politicians, instable, and a few rich people exploiting the resources and the masses of people poor. You don't see these dynamic companies and innovations coming out of such countries.
The structure of the state and the structure of politics within China imbues it with a kind of a special place in the world of today, given, you know, the power of the great firewall, to take an example, and as you say, the quite, to our minds, quite authoritarian facial recognition for jaywalking, as a slightly extreme example, but somewhat does set it apart from those counterfactuals that you lay out there, James.
Yes.
But one key question in terms of future development for China is how they approach the reform of their state-owned enterprises. So 60% of China's economy are state-owned enterprises. They're still a very dominant part of the Chinese economy. As of now, the state sector is significantly less productive than the private sector. These great examples that we have about Chinese innovation, Huawei, Alibaba, Tencent, these are private sector companies. But there is a vast swathe of the Chinese economy that is the state sector. And how China approaches the reform of that is going to be very critical for whether it will achieve higher income status in the future. There are some positive signs. So they are trying to implement what they call mixed ownership reform, which is to give incentives to senior management of state-owned enterprises to get more of a private sector mindset. I mean, the great issue in these companies is that you simply cannot fire anyone. So, it's what you have this concept of the iron rice bowl. This is a job for life. It creates a disincentive to innovate, to put your neck out, to take any kind of risk, and it results in laziness within these organizations. The government are trying to address that with these things like mixed ownership reform. And then also there is a greater imperative for these state-owned enterprises to pay a dividend up to government. So with the income tax cuts and more recently the VAT tax cuts, in order to balance the budget, the Chinese government needs the state-owned enterprises to start paying higher dividends. And that results in an impetus for them to improve profitability.
Interesting. I'd like to move the conversation on slightly to what I think is in many people's minds, and many investment analyst notes of the last year or so, are the hard landing risks of China. We hear this phrase a lot about China's going for a hard landing or a soft slowdown of growth, or the weight of Chinese debt is at some point going to overwhelm it and experience a crash similar to that seen in the US and Europe of the 2008 financial crisis. So, James, can I turn to you a little bit more about the debt situation in China? How can we understand where it is now, and does it pose a hard landing risk?
Yes, so clearly there's a lot of debt of Chinese corporates in China, but the key is that the holders of that debt are also Chinese citizens in China. So I mentioned the countries that escaped the middle income trap and became high income countries. Mm-hmm. Some of those were the PIGS, Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain. And we know that they had a boom and they borrowed lots of money from the Germans. Yep. And when it was clear that it was unsustainable, the Germans turned off the taps and they had a hard landing. They couldn't roll over the loans, their economies cratered and they had a severe recession. But the other winners was countries like Japan. And I think China is more similar to Japan than it is to a typical emerging market. It hasn't borrowed from overseas. Mm-hmm. It has relatively sound government finances. And so the government could just write off these loans and recapitalize the banks and just keep things going for longer.
I guess what makes China so special then, when it is so state-centric, is that the government owns a lot more assets than perhaps anyone else does, both in terms of property, land, as well as, you know, big financial assets as well. Is that a good way of understanding it, that they simply have more to sell in those instances?
So yeah, I certainly, from my perspective, I feel that the bare arguments around the debt do ignore the other side of the balance sheet, the fact that the Chinese government own a huge number of assets that they could monetize. I mean, they own all the roads, they own all the infrastructure. There are a lot of things that could be privatized to offset the debt that's there in the country.
The question is, do they need to? Has it reached a point where that's a necessary thing for the Chinese government to do?
Well, if I go back to the comparison, say, with Japan, Japan's land prices and stock market peaked around about 1990, but they didn't have a banking crisis for another 8 years, which was probably due to loans they made to Thailand and the rest of Asia going sour. What you had was just a very slow process of unwinding those loans. There is perhaps a risk of zombie banks or zombie companies in China.
Could you define what's a zombie bank?
It's basically a bank. So I'm just giving a stereotypical example. They've made a loan to some state-owned enterprise in a deteriorating sector, maybe low-end manufacturing, maybe resources, where they're not competitive versus, say, Australia. It's unprofitable. Mm-hmm. They're told by, you know, there is Communist Party leadership on all of these companies. They're told you have to keep that company going, the job for life.
Yeah.
And so you can never write off that loan. You can never make profits from it. And that means they don't have the balance sheet to lend to the new innovative companies, the AIs, the companies that might be coming out. Mm-hmm. And so what a zombie bank is, it's a bank that is unable to make fresh loans to new startups, and that would therefore stifle innovation.
Viral, has that been your perspective as well?
So it's certainly from, I would say, my view is I don't think that there is a crisis imminent a debt crisis imminent in China. And the major reason behind my view is the balance sheets of the large central banks are very clean. Mm-hmm. They have very low NPLs, very low non-performing loans. And you know, the bad loans are really confined to the regional banks, to the rural lenders. And what we went through a slower period of economic growth in 2016, and we saw that the government were able to recapitalize these banks, or in some cases have these banks acquired by others to resolve these debt problems. And then for the one thing we should it's important to note is that China still has capital controls. The Chinese, the individual in China has limited places to save and to store their money, and that is a license to make profit for the banking system. They are able to offer lower interest rates, and so any debt issues that appear can be resolved, or can be the balance sheets of these banks can be repaired through the fact that they can have higher net interest margins because they're able to offer lower rates, and because the Chinese consumer doesn't have any really other option other than to put their money with these banks.
I was going to add, the fact that China is a socialist country could actually help it, because one of the ways out of these crises is to socialise the banks.
Yep.
One of the problems that Japan had is the government was not willing to kind of clear out the banks and recapitalise them, because that was seen as bad politics.
Moving away from having privatised them quite so early.
Yeah. And you've seen this in the UK, how difficult it was to bail out the bankers. Why is it austerity for the NHS and for the teachers, but the banks get bailed out? One of the criticisms, you can't have private sector profits in banks in the good times, but socialist bailouts in the bad times. Mm-hmm. But perhaps because China is a socialist system with the Communist Party at the top of every single institution, it will probably be a lot easier to recapitalise the banks by a socialist leadership than it would be in Japan or the United Kingdom.
Exactly. The precedent and the structure is already in place for that to take
place.
Right? And I'm so glad that you, Viral, brought up the consumer, because, again, I feel like we've really focused this conversation on very much the average person in China and how they're developing as part of China's major development. Where is consumer debt right now? As you say, there's sort of a limited place for consumers to put their money with the capital controls. Where are they borrowing? And are they borrowing too much, as we might think of consumer debt in the US and Europe? And what about homes, mortgage debt? How can we understand these measures for China?
So China is coming from a place where saving rates were extremely high in the past. Consumer leverage, very, very low. Consumer leverage has increased quite quickly. Yeah. So certainly growth in mortgages has been quite significant. But having said that, the overall level of consumer debt, when you compare to other countries, is still quite low. There's certainly nothing that would raise concerns for me in terms of consumer borrowing. Loan to values are very low. Consumers haven't leveraged up to the hilt. And, I certainly think if you compare China to countries, Western countries, US, UK, they are. Saving rates are still very high, and the overall level of consumer debt is low.
So we can begin to wrap this conversation up with bringing it really back to the investment perspective from the economist perspective of an asset manager and a fund manager's view. Where and how can we understand these major developments in China within an investment framework? Viral.
So from my perspective, I think the key thing is valuation. So what we look for are companies where the consumption opportunity is not fairly priced. So from my perspective, that's why China Mobile looks particularly interesting. So that the work that we did recently comparing the value of mobile phone subscribers between different countries shows that China Mobile's mobile phone subscribers are valued at only $150 per mobile subscriber. So that's similar to telecom operators in the Philippines and Indonesia, where consumers pay much lower amounts for their monthly phone bills. People simply haven't classed or understood that China Mobile is exposed to the consumption story. Because looking across markets with varying income levels, we find that people tend to pay more on their phone bills as they get richer. That surprises some people, because you don't consciously think about spending more money on mobile services as your income rises. It's a necessity, and you're not consciously saying, oh, when I get my pay rise, I'm going to spend more on my mobile phone bill. But you may not spend as much time shopping around for a cheaper deal, or maybe spend less, pay less attention on your data allowances as your income rises. So there's a very clear trend between rising incomes and rising mobile phone average revenue per user. So given that the market is valuing China Mobile at a similar level per subscriber as the Philippines, we feel it's hugely undervaluing it. Mm-hmm. China's current GDP is similar to richer countries like Malaysia. And if China's if China Mobile's subscribers were valued in the same way as Malaysia's Malaysia's major telecoms mobile subscribers, they would be valued five times more than they are currently. Yeah, and you know, the great upside for China Mobile would be if one day it were valued at similar levels to Taiwanese mobile subscribers. That would imply more than 1,000% return for the shares.
Bloody hell. that's an impressive kind of gap between market expectations and the broader consumption story. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much to both of you. So to sum up, I feel like what I've understood from this conversation is that China's contribution to global growth is largely underappreciated by the market as it stands now, because it hasn't taken into account the consumption opportunity for the Chinese consumer and the broader China's development into the world economic system. Have I got that right?
So broadly, I would agree that I feel that the China's consumption opportunity is underestimated by, mm-hmm. by the market. But I would say it varies by asset. So I think, you know, within equities, there are some examples where the market, I feel, has priced it in. So if you look at, you know, Alibaba, that's on 35 times PE. And I feel that to some extent, the investor base at Alibaba do understand that there is a consumption opportunity there. But I feel that for in other areas, it's clearly not in the price. Mm-hmm. So for China Mobile, you know, and also some of the more indirect plays. So Qantas, for example, is an Australian airline. People, you know, dismiss it as, oh, just another airline, they're not recognizing that Australia is one of the most popular destinations for Chinese consumers for outbound travel. Qantas makes most of its profits from domestic flights. When Chinese consumers arrive in Sydney, they tend to take an additional flight to Brisbane, to Melbourne. So yeah, Qantas is trading on about four times EV EBITDA. So I feel that the market as a whole hasn't appreciated quite how global and how widespread the implications of the growth in Chinese consumption is.
Well, I think that's a fascinating note to end a really great discussion on. Thank you so much, Viral, for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, James.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to find out more about any of their fascinating research, be sure to visit our blog, the Future World blog. Viral's written a great piece called What's the Value of a Chinese Mobile Phone Subscriber? And James's piece, Why 5% is the New 15%. Thank you so much for listening and see you again next week. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in Legal & General investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.